The race for South Dakota governor could offer political intrigue as the Republican Party looks to the future. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, April 23rd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Seth Tupper joins us for today's Dakota Political Junkies conversation. We'll look at who might throw their hats in the ring to be the state's next leader, from a powerful incumbent to a popular congressman to potential attacks from the right flank of the party. We'll also check the headlines from one of the state's most talked about governors. Secretary Kristi Noem made news over the holiday break for a security breach and for the amount of cash in her handbag. Can Noem pivot all news in her favor? But first, Secretary Kelly Wasco offers insight into Project Prison Reset. That's coming up after the news. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. This past legislative session, the South Dakota State Legislature disagreed on how to fund a new men's prison. Governor Larry Roden has called for a reset on the prison project. We're checking in now with Kelly Wasco. She's Secretary of the Department of Corrections for the state of South Dakota. I connected with her on the phone. I want to back up a little bit because once the new news stories come out and one builds on top of the other, you know, a narrative can take place about what is going on with the Project Prison Reset. So I want to take a couple steps back and just ask you from a big picture standpoint what you think the opportunity is. The challenge is yes, but also the opportunity of building a new state prison for men in South Dakota.
South Dakota has a lot of opportunities at this point in replacing this facility. As we know, it's been toured by many legislators and external stakeholders, identified that there's an overwhelming response that it needs to be replaced. It's had its day in purpose in corrections for South Dakota, but we've, you know, outpaced by the evolution of modern and safe correctional structures and practices, which gives us an opportunity to now bring in facilities that have modern rehabilitative spaces that include, you know, educational areas, vocational areas, program areas, treatment areas, hobby areas, and take another look at how we confine offenders and what modern practices we can actually bring into the structure that's going to give better outcomes for behaviors.
Is that possible in the current space? Was that something that didn't exist? Tell us a little bit about the ways that the current space has been configured for modern practices and the limitations of that.
When you look at rehabilitation and corrections, you know, rehabilitation is affected by design. So when you look at the design of a facility, there's things, the physical elements, the natural light, the colors, the design, the layout. The environment influences communication as well as interaction. So when you look at the current structure of the state penitentiary, it's what we call a linear design. And what is more modern today is direct supervision models. And there's many publications that show that the linear designs, you know, don't have the efficiencies or the benefits. You have staff that are going five tiers up. The light is not into the cells. The light is, you know, across the structure. So they have passive light, but they don't have direct light, poor lighting. The temperature control in the facility is yes, there was air conditioning put in there, and yes, there's heat in there, but you still have a significant difference between the first tier and the fifth tier. So in the summer, the first tier is cool and the fifth tier is hot. And in the winter, the fifth tier is warm and the first tier is cool. Mm. So it's structurally outdated. We have some structural issues with it. It doesn't have the adequate program space. It's very difficult to have jobs for offenders in that type of physical plant. So that's just some of the reasons that trigger us to look into a new design.
So as people come forward in the public input phase of the reset, are you hearing new and innovative ideas, or are you kind of sitting back and hearing a rehash, or, hey, we already walked down this path, but we're walking it down again publicly, or are there new ideas coming to the table?
Sure. So, you know, we had a good plan and it didn't have the buy-in. So, you know, when I got here, and I try to remind folks that when I got here, I got the DLR report handed to me and said, you know what, here you go. This is what we want you to work from. With having a new administration, you know, now we're looking for a plan that everybody can agree to, you know, a plan that fits what we need as a correctional operation, as well as, you know, what does the state need? So, of course, we have to look at our existing assets, and one of those existing assets is the Lincoln County land. But we also are receiving, we have an RFI that's open through this week. The end of this week, the RFI will close, and that's for proposals for land. So, you know, having people put those options out there for us to say, hey, can we erect something in another location? And I'm completely open to that, but the decision makers are the task force. And when the task force gets that information and does that review as we go through the timeline of the special session that's going to be July 22nd, you know, all work comes to halt that first part of July so that we can move to special session and hopefully have a good resolution that has buy-in from everybody.
Can you say how many proposals you've had so far, new proposals for that RFI?
You know what? I don't know how many have actually come in because I don't check on it. I wait till the very end and then I get involved.
Okay.
So I've just heard some of the folks that do look in it, but I know that there's more than four or five.
Okay. And you said you kind of inherited that original report. When did you arrive? When did you come to your current position?
I came the March 1st of 2022, and the DLR report was concluded in the fall of 2021.
All right. So when people talk about size, one of the things we hear reported a lot is how big is big enough? How big is too big? One big facility, several smaller facilities throughout the state. What's your response to some of those questions or concerns?
Well, there's a lot that goes into determining the size of what you need. For me, I looked at the DLR report, which identified that level five facility, which a level five facility houses all custody levels. You know, there's numerous assessments out there that have been done. You know, some say build a bunch of small facilities. Some say, you know, build a bigger facility. And my response to that is for every facility you build, whether there's 100 beds in it or 2,000 beds in it, you have to have a warden. You have to have a kitchen. You have to have medical, laundry, mailroom, recreation, library, teachers, mental health. So every single time you build a facility, you have to have those components for rehabilitation. So if I'm buying a piece of land of 30 acres to put 200 beds on, I know that I have to have all of not just the physical infrastructure, but the resource infrastructure that's required in corrections. The consultants have been hired, and they're part of, you know, the three things that the task force has to identify is, do we need a facility? How big does it need to be? And where is it going to be? And I think right now we're leaning into the consultants to say, you know, how big does it need to be? And they'll consider our average daily population, our projected growth rate, and our current sentencing practices.
So when we talk about growth rate and recidivism and what you mentioned early at the top of our interview about, you know, providing places for people, is it possible then with the new facility that we could, that people would be using the facility less? Help me understand what kind of a difference, I guess is what I'm asking, a new modern facility could make in the lives of people, but also in the cost to the state and the numbers that would have to be housed.
I mean, that's a really broad, that's a broad explanation.
Yeah.
What a facility like this does is it's several things. Is it delivers a facility that's safe for the staff and the offenders.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives us opportunities to benefit from changing behaviors, allowing offenders to be in a design that changes behaviors. Now, we would expect there's more that goes into recidivism than just a facility. The facility, though, significantly affects the rehabilitation, you know, the physical elements, the natural light, like I said before, the mm-hmm. environment influences communication and interaction. So making sure that they have a more pro-social environment and we're able to fill it. Right now, the state penitentiary does not have space allocated to it for vocational education. And I frequently hear folks confuse the difference between Pheasant Land Industries and vocational. Pheasant Land Industries is somewhere where they work and they get really good skills, but they don't walk away with some kind of a certification or a credential to say, I can go work at this location or this location and do this kind of vocational work. So our goal is to create more of those opportunities. We have a lot of opportunities for low custody offenders and some of the less risk medium custody offenders. What people don't understand is that we do have a lot of high custody medium offenders and close custody offenders that serve their time out in those higher custody facilities and go back into the community. And we have committed absolutely no vocational training into them. So it's really making sure that we're being equitable across all of the custody levels, because those higher custody levels are probably a higher risk of returning than the lower.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you know, for example, somebody who's not going to get out, and go back to what you said about changing behavior. Somebody who is serving a lifetime sentence, and people are saying that person is there for a reason. They're guilty. Yep. This is their debt to society. What does making the facility better do for their behavior, which then again impacts, you know, for example, staff safety? Say more about that, if you would, please.
You pretty much just summed it up, which shows me that it's, you know, people are getting it and it's sinking in for sure.
Okay.
Is even though those people are going to be there a long time, their debt to society is the removal of their freedoms and liberties, and they're in prison. So they're in prison as punishment, not for punishment. So while they're incarcerated, and, you know, if we make their life difficult, if we don't address their addictions issues, their behaviors continue. And what that does is disrupts the facility, it disrupts the order, and it puts the staff and other offenders at risk. So, yes, they are there for a life sentence. And, you know, many of them are aware that they're there for a life sentence, and they try to comply with prison living. But adjusting to prison living for some is very difficult and oftentimes takes the physical structure of the facility for 10 to 15 years before they finally realize they need to settle into this is how they're going to spend the rest of their natural life.
A few other locations have come up as potential ideas. The old Citibank facility in Sioux Falls. Some people have talked about a more central location out in the Pier area. You've mentioned having to wait for those proposals to come in and for the report to come in. Is there anything else you would add to that, or is it just, hey, we need to wait and see on those facilities?
We do need to wait and see. I mean, obviously, the DLR report, which I concur with, you know, we have a facility we're going to decommission in Sioux Falls. The state penitentiary has roughly 200 positions allocated to it. I think it's just under 200. So those 200 staff would go to the new facility in addition to the additional staffing. So if you moved this facility to Pier, what would happen to those 200 staff? Mm-hmm. You know, so of course we're going to be open to you know, everything that they provide for us. And in the long run, I want to make sure we have a safe, modern facility. And I want to preserve the incredible staff that we have at the state penitentiary, because they will go with to the new facility. Yeah, I've heard a lot of different locations, but I have not reviewed any of the proposals. So yeah, we will see when they make their way to the task force.
I understand you're not making some of these decisions. And I heard, Governor Larry Roden and Lieutenant Governor Tony Venhuizen in another interview saying, hey, if we don't have the votes, you know, we talk about support, but it's the votes. We have to get people to vote for this. If I was the governor and I said to you, hey, Secretary Wasco, how much is not having the votes costing me? How much is the delay costing me? How do you put that in context for people as sort of what's the cost of not moving forward or moving forward at a different pace?
The long-term cost is we don't have the right inmates in the right bed getting the right treatment. And what that does is that that keeps them in prison, and then they'll just get out of prison and keep cycling back and forth until we can identify, how can we better treat these offenders. But even more importantly to me is just the violence. It's very difficult to battle the violence in this facility with the way that the facility is structured. Mm-hmm. So I know that we do need the votes, and I'm confident that we're going to see the task force come up with a plan that everybody will agree to. That's what the governor asked them to do and has charged them with. Lieutenant Governor has been very concise and clear with the task force and with what the initiatives are. So I think it's just going to take some hard work and a lot of commitment, and we'll get something. We've got to do something. I think that's unanimous.
All right. So talk a little bit then. You mentioned just dealing with the violence in the facility now. Talk about the lockdowns that we're seeing and what the plan is going forward. What are you hearing from staff? Are those lockdowns going to be pretty much until a new facility is built? What can you tell us?
So lockdowns are an everyday occurrence in prisons.
Okay.
Many times people don't even realize a facility is locked down. They may be locked down from one day to 1 week for a multitude of reasons. There's lots of reasons we lock down a facility. It could be because we received some intelligence. It could be because we had a disturbance. It could be because we have a threat that we have to address. It's a normal piece of operations in a prison. We use it to control movement and to ensure that all of our facilities are safe. So, yeah, I mean, if we have offenders that are not adhering or are somehow breaching our security measures, then the first thing that we do is we isolate the issue, and you do that by locking down. This last lockdown, I mean, it was less than 24 hours for the whole facility. I got no less than 10 media calls in 2 hours. And in the first 2 hours, I don't know anything. My staff are still assessing the situation. And so it's difficult to answer those calls when everybody thinks there's a need to know. Sometimes lockdowns aren't triggered because of any kind of violence, but they're triggered because of something else. But they are a normal part of corrections. Now, when they go into weeks, mm-hmm. There's a reason. There's a reason that we go into a week or 2 weeks. We haven't had one for longer than 2 weeks, and there was a reason for it. So, it's a lot. It's very staff intensive. So you don't like doing them. You don't like having the inmates locked up or a loss of their movement or an idleness. And you don't like putting your staff in those situations. But it's definitely a security decision that has to be made. And that's why we make them.
Do you think there is a heightened attention from the media right now on behalf of the humans who are incarcerated, but then also because of the political attention on the new prison? That might not be a bad thing to have increased media attention on the subject as South Dakotans wake up and realize that this is part of our lives, that we have a responsibility to the people we put behind bars and to the staff who work there, to the state employees who work there. Partially good, partially bad. What do you or is it just salacious from your end? Is it just salacious reporting? What are you seeing?
You know, I've seen some great reporting. I definitely giving us a place and letting us be heard that we do need to change. We do need some evolution. You know, I think the part that's frustrating for us is not so much about what's going on with the task force. I mean, we welcome the tours. I've been doing tours since the day I got here. I was inviting people to come and tour the place with me when I was touring it for the first time.
Yeah.
So that doesn't bother us. It's when we, you know, when we have these incidents or if something's going on in a prison and, you know, again, it's this wanting to know why we're doing it, where we're doing it, who was affected, how many were affected. And like I said, you know, it's just that's very debilitating to us when we're trying to do accountability, make sure we have all of our inmates, we have all of our staff. So I think it's two different things, Lori.
Yeah.
I think the reporting on what's been going on with the need for the prison and The conditions of the prison has been fantastic, and I've appreciated the questions that I've received and actually the opportunity to explain. I've wanted to explain for quite a while, and now we're actually able to have these conversations about what it is that's going on inside the institutions.
That is South Dakota Secretary of the Department of Corrections, Kelly Wasko. She gave us an update there on Project Prison Reset. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Former Governor Kristi Noem's tenure as U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security is well underway, and that means the nation is getting a taste of her leadership style. For our Dakota Political Junkies conversation, we're going to welcome Seth Tupper to the program. He is editor-in-chief of South Dakota Searchlight. We connected from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. A security breach for Governor Kristi Noem as her credentials were and her passport, her keys, and some cash were stolen from a D.C. restaurant where she was eating with her family. People are kind of focusing on the $3,000 in cash that she had in the purse, but also the security credentials seem to be a pretty serious breach of security as well. What are you making of this news as it unfolds?
Well, somebody sent me this story in our Slack messaging app the other day, and then our organization had already seen it. But my response was, you know, there can't be a day without some kind of Noem drama, right? Not trying to blame her for her purse getting stolen because, you know, nobody wants that. You wouldn't wish it on anybody. But it's just like every day there's got to be something. just a few days before that, the Wall Street Journal did a big story about Corey Lewandowski. You know, running her office basically, and some people referring to him as the shadow secretary and that ruffling feathers and stuff. And so it's just, and you know, some of it is just, you know, she's just that seems to be that type of person that conflict and drama seem to follow her wherever she goes. But she also seems to be the type of person who thrives on that. And you wonder how much of it is accidental and how much of it is manufactured, and no matter either which way, she seems to always parlay it to her benefit somehow. So
how does she, obviously she's not, well, I shouldn't say obviously, it is highly unlikely she is manufacturing the loss of a purse,
right?
Because that's a pretty devastating thing to have happen. However, the scrutiny that is on her for leaving those things unsecured is in her role and in her position is not for nothing. The Lewandowski scrutiny has followed her for a long period of time. These are some of the things that you've been reporting on Governor Noem when she was governor for ages.
Yeah.
The cost of traveling with her, what happens when she travels, what is her relationship with Lewandowski as an advisor when she was governor of the state. These are how does she spend money? How much money does she spend? These are things that South Dakota media outlets have been covering for quite some time. And now the national media is like, well, we're not going to take a day off either.
Yeah. And, you know, with the cash, maybe she learned her lesson using credit cards. I don't know. That's why she was carrying so much cash. But, you know, some of it is unfair. You know, like, I mean, you do see a lot, especially since Noem has gone more national. Some of the headlines you see, I mean, people just absolutely picking apart her appearance and her, you know, this thing about why does she have $3,000 cash? And there is a tendency with her to pick apart the smallest thing and some unfair things. And that's unfortunate. But then on the other hand, she seems to be the type of person who realizes that, you know, or ascribes the theory that no publicity is bad. And so she takes that criticism and answers it is pugilistic about it and tries to turn everything into just more awareness of her name and who she is and her image and everything. So it's hard to say the criticism is fair or unfair sometimes because she just seems to sort of be able to use all of it, strategically.
Yeah. A court case in federal court there in Rapid City with Judge Karen Schreier and a South Dakota Mines student that is suing Kristi Noem and the Department of Homeland Security for revoking her student visa. That happened over the weekend as well. Can you give us an update on that at all?
And here we go, kind of talking about Noem again, right?
Right. Yeah. We're not done. Yeah.
More of how she dominates the news cycle. But yeah, we're looking a little further into this, and hopefully I'll have a story soon on more of a system-wide look at what's happening with international students in South Dakota at public universities. But yeah, there was a graduate student at South Dakota Mines here in Rapid City that is from India and is here on a visa, is here legally to get a graduate degree. And apparently was, you know, as far as we know from the lawsuit, was had a traffic citation, I guess, if you want to call it that, not pulling over, I think, for an emergency vehicle. And based on that, the Department of Homeland Security, you know, under Kristi Noem, moved to remove this person from the country, mm-hmm. Which, you know, again, stokes all kinds of headlines and right. questions. And, you know, I mean, and my reaction to it, I think a lot of people's was, you know, when before President Trump came into office the second time, a lot of what he said and a lot of the people around him said was, well, you know, we're going to focus on the worst of the worst, the people who are here illegally, people who have committed serious crimes. And, you know, so it certainly raises a lot of questions about, you know, somebody who is convicted of a traffic citation and is here legally getting their graduate degree.
Yeah.
Is this the type of person that, you know, right. we want to be going after in mass raids of getting people out of the country who are here illegally? Because this is a person who is here legally.
Right. So, and part of the challenge here is who has the authority to make the decision. And then the other question is, do the American people think that this is the right decision? And there's a lot to unpack there as well, I think.
Yeah. And how's it going to affect, you know, South Dakota? I mean, this is obviously an issue for this person and her life. But, you know, I was looking at the numbers this morning. About a third of the graduate students at South Dakota Mines are international students, are people who are not American citizens, who are here on a visa and are here legally. So, you know, these kinds of things do stoke a culture of fear. And I think in Rapid City traditionally, and I know a lot of universities are probably the same. I mean, these international students have been welcomed as people who are, you know, doing research, you know, a high level of research that contributes to the economy and is a positive thing. So, you know, the judge so far has ordered temporarily ordered the government to not remove this person from the country as the case proceeds. But there have been further filings that looks like the government is going to pursue this and try to, you know, keep up with it. Meanwhile, graduation is May 10th. And so, you know, maybe they're able to run out the clock and this person is able to just graduate and move on with their lives. But it does look like the government is gonna pursue this.
Right. But that relationship, as you know, to your point at Mines, the number of researchers on the faculty and the student body and PhD programs and postdocs that come through Mines and other universities throughout the state doing that research, if those are shut down because of a traffic ticket and people cannot come back or communicate, that really impacts the future of an institution.
Absolutely. And the state, you know, it's a personal tragedy, obviously, for that person if they're not able to complete the degree. But when you think about a third of the graduate students at Mines being these kinds of students, I mean, that's a lot of research that doesn't get done. That's a lot of businesses and products and patents and things that don't come out of the research that doesn't get done. And, you know, that has an effect on the state as a whole. So, it's an important case for one person, but it's also important, I think, culturally and economically, you know, for the state.
And I suspect there will be more cases in the future, more South Dakotans. What are you hearing from people just about their anxieties or their concerns about things? Because a lot of the conversations are not happening like you and I are having a public conversation now that people will listen to. A lot of these conversations are happening behind closed doors as people figure out how to navigate what's ahead. And I know I have tons of people contacting me, but they're not, you know, willing to go on the radio yet, and some things are not reportable yet. Are you having the same situation where there's just a ton of people reaching out, but there's just a lot of question marks about what actually is going to happen?
Exactly. Yeah, we do have a reporter working on, like as I said, a broader story right now, and just there's a lot of fear. I mean, obviously, I think, you know, everybody else in a similar situation looks at this woman who is the subject of this case and says that, well, you know, if she's got a traffic citation, is the thing on her record that they're using to try to deport her? Well, yeah, then that kind of opens up everybody to think, well, then You know, I don't want to do anything. I don't want to say anything. I don't want anybody to notice me, you know. So, so yeah, getting people to speak out is pretty hard. And even getting information from the universities, sadly, has been hard. You know, in a lot of other states, in some other states, I've seen coverage where the university system will come right out and say, yeah, we confirm that we've had, you know, 43 students have been affected by this or whatever, or have been, you know, we're not getting that kind of ready information from our university system in South Dakota, unfortunately.
Well, let me ask you this too. And again, we're still talking about Kristi Noem, governor and secretary. You know, we had some questions that we reached out to different congressional offices and were directed to Department of Homeland Security saying, hey, we don't have clarity on this. We think you should talk to DHS. Of course, we reach out to DHS and we get no response. Now, we know when Governor Noem was governor, she wasn't always in front of the press in a way that the press enjoyed. She would disagree with that assessment. However, just being able to come to the media and explain what's happening would solve some of the problems. Some of, would provide some clarity.
Well, it'd be nice. And yeah, we hit the same wall, you know, just, you know, with the Department of Homeland Security saying they don't comment on individual cases, but, and what
I can't get them to
comment
on anything.
Yeah. Yeah. We recently asked for this particular one, but we would like somebody from the administration to answer that question I raised earlier, which is, you know, if really what the administration is doing here is going after, you know, what Trump has said in the past is the worst criminals and, you know, et cetera, that are here illegally that shouldn't be in the country, et cetera, then why are they going after
a
graduate student who's pursuing a graduate degree and had a and again, you know, I've talked about this being a traffic citation where that's all part of the courts and there's more details there, but it's just, I would love to get an answer to that question, is what is the strategy here? Are these the type of people that, why are they going after these types of people, I guess, rather than what we heard as a theme earlier, which was more of, we're going to go after more of the hardcore criminals, the worst of the worst, et cetera.
Yeah. All right. So Senator John Thune, Senator Mike Rounds, Congressman or Representative Dusty Johnson all come home to South Dakota during the congressional recess, and they are met with protests in some cases. What sort of responses are people seeing in the streets when our elected leaders come to town now?
Yeah, we had a reporter, Mackenzie Huber, went to Senator Thune's appearance in Watertown, and there were some protesters there, as she reported. You know, it was interesting. Senator Thune had, sort of mature, thoughtful response to it, and just said that, you know, these folks have every right to speak out, and he said he understands that they're upset with some of the Trump administration's policies, and they have every right to say that, et cetera. There's kind of this game going on, obviously, on both sides, where a lot of people who are angry and upset about what's happening with the country or have latched on this idea that the members of Congress should be doing town halls. And, and of course, you know, I mean, part of that is we all know that they would get berated and, you know, at the town halls. And so, of course, they don't want to do it, right? and they're saying, well, here I am. I'm accessible in other ways. I don't have to do a town hall. So there's this back and forth that I don't think is terribly, you know, productive, because one side in some ways wants the congressional delegation to be mercilessly berated in public. And, you know, of course, do have an obligation to put themselves up for the public and maybe should be willing to do that, but you can see why they don't want to. So there's a tension there now, and it's where it's heading, I guess, is anybody's guess. But of course, we do have some elections coming up next year, and that may be where we get our answer finally. Is we've seen, you know, in a lot of these protests that have happened throughout South Dakota, that we had a great commentary from Mary Garrigan recently, how the anger is not only directed at Trump and the Trump administration, but a lot of these protesters are also directing their anger at the congressional delegation, and there seems to be a rising tide of sort of anger against them among some people.
Which gets the idea of what is the role of Congress in providing, you know, some of these cuts have come where you would, you know, the money was already appropriated by Congress, and then the executive branch decides that it's not going where it's supposed to go, and some people are just frustrated at that process. Of someone not saying, no, wait, we appropriated that. Now we might cut it next time, but it should go through this different process of just executive order after executive order because of the precedent that it sets. Even if you think those funds should be cut, whoever's next after President Trump will have a precedent of behavior.
Yeah, and I think what we've seen and heard from people at these protests is they're angry at the response or lack thereof from the congressional delegation, which a lot of what we've seen and heard from them has been a sort of a shoulder shrug saying they recognize that the problems and some of the process of you know, the Department of Government Efficiency and different cuts and things that have happened, and with Senator Rounds and the others saying, you know, okay, we recognize there's been some problems here and there, and we're working to solve the problems that have been caused by some cuts that maybe weren't thought out. But beyond that, there hasn't been any sort of stiff, you know, resistance to what's happening and maybe the way that President Trump is sort of, as some people would say, usurping the power of Congress. And there, among the protesters, there seems to be a lot of desire for the congressional delegation to do more to protect you know, the power of Congress and stop Congress from being run over by President Trump.
Are you seeing a lot of counter-protesters or people who are, you know, very enthusiastic about the current administration's agenda and how quickly things are moving? They're feeling really good about the direction of the country. Are they showing up in any measurable way that you've seen publicly?
No, I think here and there, you know, a few instances of that, but not on any large scale. No, that doesn't seem to be. And maybe that's a function of just, you know, this being an off year, really. And if we were an election year, maybe we'd be seeing a lot more of that, obviously. Yeah. But
meanwhile, speaking of elections, we should talk about the race for South Dakota governor shaping up. And we do have Governor Larry Roden, who, and then some potential challengers to him in the future. What are some of the things that you're seeing for next year's election that are already taking some shape?
Yeah. And here we go. And why are we talking about this? Because of Kristi Noem, right? Because she decided to leave the governor's office.
Right.
So everything goes back to her. But it is shaping up to be one of the more interesting governor's races we've had, really, I think, since the Billy Sutton.
We'd be talking
Kristi
about
Noem
it anyway
race.
Because she'd be done.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. She
yeah.
would be vacating
but she
one
certainly
way or the
has,
other. Yeah.
She certainly, by leaving, put Larry Roden in a much, much improved position with him being able to capitalize on getting some things done in the legislature and all of that. So it is, you know, I mean, Governor Roden, I don't think has said that he's running, but if you look at his actions since day one, it has seemed like he's going to be running. So, I mean, I fully expect him to run. Dusty Johnson, Congressman Johnson, is widely rumored to be considering, well, he's acknowledged that he's thinking about it, I guess, so could be running for governor. And then we have the Speaker of the State House, John Hansen, and the Speaker pro tem, Carla Lems, making an announcement Thursday that looks like it's going to be them announcing a run for governor. So if you have that, and there could be others in the race, I mean, what an interesting race that is going to be if you have a Roden, Johnson, Hansen race, and maybe a couple others. I think wildly unpredictable how that would turn out.
Seth Dupper is editor-in-chief of South Dakota Searchlight. He stepped in for our Dakota Political Junkies conversation today. You can find all that political analysis on your favorite podcasting platform. Search for SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The next episode of South Dakota Focus takes viewers into Hill City and DeSmet. The episode focuses on tourism challenges and opportunities in those towns. SDPB's Jackie Hendry stepped into our Kirby family studio here in Sioux Falls with a preview. This time we're going to start in Hill City.
Yes, so we heard from Hill City a bit last month when we talked about short-term rentals.
Okay.
But we also spent a lot of time talking with Hill City about a project they have underway related to their wastewater management system. So Hill City, really, tourism is a major industry for them. A lot of hotels, a lot of visitors in those peak summer months. What we might not know is that the water usage in Hill City, so your sinks, your toilets, this and that, increases by 400%.
Oh, really?
In those peak tourist months.
Huh.
Obviously, that's a significant strain on the infrastructure.
Yeah.
And so Hill City has reached a point where they need to basically double the size of their wastewater management system in order to, you know, expand for that peak season and then be able to basically turn off half of that system for the rest of the year
And is the peak getting peakier? It's growing. So the peak is, because this is a problem they've probably always had since they became.
Yeah. This is an instance of, in a certain way, kind of paying for your own success.
Right.
In order to continue to sustain the visitor industry, this is something that really the community has to figure out.
Right. All right. So if you live there year round, how is this impacting you?
Really, you're going to see this living there year-round by an uptick in your utility payments. And we heard from the city administrator, Nate Anderson, in Hill City. Really, for a lot of full-time residents, this might be the first time they've seen an increase in their water bill in maybe many decades. And it's a pretty significant increase. It's hard to gauge, you know, there's not really an average user, but say if you, and this is according to Nate Anderson, say 1,000 gallons a month usage, originally have paid $25 a month, now you're paying about $50 a month.
That is putting a tremendous demand on our fixed income folks that live here in town that have been here all their life, haven't seen sewer and water rates increase significantly. Perhaps that was a mistake, but that's where we're at. And now we're trying to make it right. And those are tough decisions that the city council and the mayor have had to wrestle with over the last year or two.
Okay, so how have people responded?
As you can expect, a certain level of frustration. And this has been kind of an ongoing conversation in recent years. But again, Nate Anderson saying that there's some frustration with residents and a little bit of tension about really whose problem it is to solve.
Certainly there are frustrated folks that feel, why did my water bill go up when we're trying to solve a hotel problem? Now, the hotel owner would tell you, I'm bringing a lot of revenue in. I'm paying for every gallon of water that I use and put through the sewer as well. And some of those hotel owners are local here, so they make that argument, and it's a valid one as well.
Now, Hill City did recently receive a pretty significant loan from the State Department of Ag and Natural Resources for water projects, a couple grant funds and things like this, but really still looking at a multi-million dollar project over the next basically 6 years of development, and that will continue to show up in residents' pocketbooks.
And if you don't do it,
you lose your industry.
You lose your industry.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Let's head to DeSmet now.
DeSmet was, I really enjoyed going back to DeSmet. We visited them in October talking about kind of history and tourism. Of course, DeSmet known for being a place where Laura Ingalls Wilder grew up, that Ingalls homestead still up there. And there are kind of multiple sort of infrastructure flavored projects happening in DeSmet. You've got, you know, century old water mains in historic downtown that need to be replaced and things like this. But what I find interesting in DeSmet that we talk about in this episode is the development of a new trail system. So it's kind of this amenity that would serve both residents and visitors. You don't have a lot of trails kind of on this eastern side of the
state. You mean like a hiking trail,
a biking trail, kind of multi-use.
Okay.
Originally kind of envisioned along the Big Slough, if you're familiar with that landmark in the Little House on the Prairie series. It's also very near a game, fish, and parks kind of game production area, some really beautiful prairie habitat. And got to meet Nancy Montross. She and her husband Bob drove by this this area every day, and they're kind of those community dreamers who like see an opportunity and advocate for it. And so Nancy talks about, this is today's world. People want trails. They want biking and hiking opportunities. This is a chance for us to give one more, you know, offering to the people who come and visit us, looking to learn more about Laura Ingalls Wilder, and then on top of that have other recreation opportunities.
They're coming here for the pioneer, for Laura Ingalls Wilder, her generation, her era. So we need to still portray that, but we can't live in yesterday. We have to live in today and tomorrow. So we have to figure out where the breaking point is there and how to bond the two of them together. And I think we have a number of people in DeSmet in this area that are really good at that. They still want to maintain their roots, but they know that they have to progress or else you die. I mean, that's just the way it is, especially in a small community.
All right, what's ahead for this project?
So it looks like the very first leg of that trail is going to be constructed this summer. That's basically from the edge of DeSmet right up to that Big Slough, and there's going to be some, you know, signage and things like this. But this is right along Highway 14, and for those in the know, Highway 14 really runs in the entirety of South Dakota, east to west, predates Interstate 90. And so those community dreamers kept dreaming bigger and bigger to this idea of what if we had the historic Highway 14 trail across the state of South Dakota. Never had anything like this before. It would be kind of a one-of-its-kind thing. That's an early-stage thing.
Yeah.
But as far as DeSmet is concerned, there were already three phases of this DeSmet leg of the Highway 14 trail in progress. There was an international competition for an observation tower to be built near this trail so that tourists can actually see Silver Lake by the shores of Silver Lake. Right now, visitors can't really see it. It's kind of difficult to see, and that's a big draw. So I think DeSmet has really taken this idea from two people and expanded it into this really grand vision of what a community with a shared vision can reach for and accomplish, and with a lot of different partnerships.
Yeah. So two people can't do it all.
No.
Good idea. It doesn't happen on its own. So what do we need to remember about the scale of these projects and who has to, what needs to really happen to get the next visionary thing forward?
Right. All of these things happen with a lot of cooperation, and sometimes that comes with conflict, right? People have different ideas of how to make things happen. The executive director of the Economic Development Corporation in DeSmet, Jamie Lancaster, he talked with me about kind of the process of brainstorming these things, particularly with some revitalization ideas with DeSmet's historic downtown. Mm-hmm. And I thought he had something really interesting to say about how to approach ways of managing change effectively.
The people who seem to be against you, they care as much as you do. It's not that people are against doing things well. It's oftentimes, it's difficult to let go of what once was. And that's kind of the key there, is what once was. A lot of what needs to change are things that we've already lost. Our downtown is a beautiful place. It used to be much more beautiful. But things get old, right? Things age. And I think anybody who's not a teenager can attest to that process, right? And so there is a process of letting go and realizing that it is gone. What isn't gone can be a part of where we are going forward to. Mm-hmm. And incorporating that well, I think, is one of the ways that you manage that change.
Jackie Hendry, what else and what's next on this upcoming South Dakota Focus?
So you'll hear more about the wastewater system in Hill City. You'll hear more about DeSmet and the various projects ongoing. You'll hear a little bit from South Dakota Game, Fish, and Parks about working with landowners to preserve that all-important hunting habitat, and a little bit from the president of the board for the Association of Towns and Townships on maintaining rural roads to those remote habitats that both locals and visitors enjoy. And then that'll lead us up to our final episode already of our season of tourism for South Dakota Focus next month. And that's when we will dive deep into a conversation about workforce and staffing up for those peak tourist months.
Here it comes. Here they come. The tourists are on their way to South Dakota. We are getting ready. That's SDPB's Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. You can catch the next episode this week, Thursday, April 24th, 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain, on SDPB TV 1. And of course, you can always find it online at sdpb.org/watch. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.